Ladies and gentlemen, and fellow golfers, for your entertainment.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa, brought to you by the Hagen Oaks Golf Super Shop, America's most awarded golf facility. Naturewood Home Furnishings, where it's all about choices and always about quality.
Welcome into the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sacktown Sports 1140. Hi, I'm Frank LaRosa. He's Scott Marsh. Scott, we have a full packed show and not much time to talk to you about anything right now.
Our shows go fast, but it's all about our great guests.
So we have them today. Phil Dawson, the instructor of Corey Pereira, a local PGA professional, just played in the U.S. Open, and you had a chance to actually see them both down at L.A. Country Club.
Yeah, it was great following him around the course. What a great local story.
And it'll be fun to find out more personally from both of them. Mike Schumann, who's going to be playing in the Gold Rush Classic coming up in July at Rancho Marietta. Mike played for the 49ers for a few years and was a local television celebrity in the Bay Area as well. And he's going to tell us a little bit about Joe Montana and folks like that, and maybe even talk a little bit about the Gold Rush Classic, which is a charity-based celebrity AM tournament coming up July, 12th and 13th, I think?
13th and 14th, yep.
Here we go. I knew I was close to it. Anyway, we have more than we can handle right now, so I'm just going to break here and do a couple of messages and come right back with Corey and Phil Dawson.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sacktown Sports.
You are listening to the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sacktown Sports 1140. I'm Frank LaRosa. Scott Marsh is beside. And Scott, this is going to be a really exciting segment on the show. I know you just came back from the L.A. Country Club and the U.S. Open, and we have some people that actually had a little closer view than you did.
No doubt. It's always great. The U.S. Open's truly America's tournament. We've got a local golfer who participated, and his story's, you know, just remarkable. And I'm looking forward to this.
Corey Pereira is the six-year PGA professional local guy that you talked about that played in the U.S. Open. Philip Dawson is his coach for many years. And Philip is with the Performance Golf Academy. And gentlemen, welcome to both of you to the show.
Thank you.
Honored to be here.
You guys have a really interesting story. As I mentioned, you've kind of been together a long time. Philip, how did you meet Corey? And you know, all of a sudden, this good luck charm came into your life. How'd that all come about?
Well, I would say I was playing professionally myself, and Corey was the little kid at the range when I was home practicing. I played 3 years on PGA Tour Canada and played 6 years full-time professional golf myself. And Corey grew up at the country club that I happened to practice at. And so he was the little kid who would be on the range, you know, asking to go, play golf when I was home, or we'd, practice and hit balls and stuff like that. And so, yeah, you know, I would say our relationship started originally when I was playing pro golf, and I don't know that I would call it organized coaching. I would more just give him some suggestions while I was home. And then, you know, when I quit, winded down my playing career, and he was kind of revving up his, I started coaching him full time. But I think I met Corey when he was 9. I probably started coaching him when he was about 12.
Corey, you were described as the little kid that came around and kind of, you know, wondered what was going on there. And boy, the description of you certainly has changed after the few years you've had on the PGA Tour, and certainly your performance at the U.S. Open. How would you describe that whole relationship?
Yeah, it was, I would say I was probably the annoying little kid. kidding, right? And that kind of evolved as I think there was an understanding between Phil and I that I did want to take it to the next level. And I was willing to put in the work, and I was fortunate enough to meet Phil, another guy who was willing to put in the work and match my energy. So our relationship evolved from there, both as a friendship and as a business, you know, and we started at a very young age, and we both worked very hard, and he wasn't afraid to call me out at times and call me lazy, or, hey, you're not working hard enough. You need to be doing this. You need to be in the gym. You need to be eating better. And that's really what made us tick is, you know, Phil wasn't afraid to be honest with me from a very young age.
You know, anybody that is interested in golf in Northern California has come across your name at one point or another. You've amassed, a pretty significant, bit of tournament wins and successes along the way. Tell us when you started, what were you expecting and some of the successes that you've had.
Sorry, that's Phil.
That was for you, Corey.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Corey, that'd be a really short list if he's asking for my success compared to yours.
Well, yeah, hey, Phil had a good playing career too. For me, kind of climbing that hill, you just got to start slow, I think, right? And, you start on the local level, kind of winning some tournaments, and then, your game evolves to the national level. And, I think my whole career has been one big evolution, right, where you're just trying to get a little bit better each year, a little bit better in different uncomfortable situations. And, really it did start in Northern California for me, with the NCGA and, local first tee events. And, it evolved, to national and international events and eventually the U.S. Open.
Philip, as a coach, as you're bringing someone along and you obviously recognize they have talent, success does not happen at every turn. What are the secrets to kind of keeping someone's head straight and keeping him interested? Obviously, Corey is someone that was really excited and wanted to stay involved. But, at some point we all kind of get down on ourselves. What in those moments, what do you do to kind of keep things fresh?
Yeah, well, I think, Frank, I've been fortunate to, and really Corey was probably my second real student ever. I mean, he and another young man who Jake Johnson, who played locally, and he has the course record at Hagen Oaks in the State Fair. He shot 60 in the State Fair, and they were really my first two students. And again, they were just the little kids at the range at Cameron Park that were my buddies that I'd go play golf with. I'll be honest, someone like Corey, I realized at a very young age, had a special gift. And so then it's really just, I think like a lot of failed players, because that's what I am, I wanted to figure out why I came up short. And for someone like Corey, who has more talent potential and things like that than I probably had, you just share those mistakes and things that you would do differently. And also to get as good as I got, I did a lot of things right. So, I've just tried to share with him my experiences over the years. Really at about, I think he was about 15, he called me one night and was kind of complaining he wasn't winning more. And, I wouldn't say I would have agreed, but I just kind of told him, well, hey, I don't know that you're working that hard. And so a year later, he was a top 10 junior in the country. And, his game was really starting to take off. He won the National Optimist Junior, shooting 15 under by 9 shots or something like that. And, he really just started to take on this trajectory. So I'll be honest, to keep him interested, I don't think was really hard. I think his interest levels, like most elite players, he's a bit crazy at times and obsessive. And really it was more just giving him a path of information and things to do and keeping him on task with, looking at his technique, looking at his fitness and his equipment and things like that. And just really letting his talent blossom, so to speak. By the time he got into college, oh gosh, I'm going to guess, he can correct me if I'm wrong, but probably a sophomore summer or junior year, I mean, he had gone into the top 10 in the world amateur rankings. And so, at that point now, as a coach, you start worrying about screwing them up more than helping them. They're so good. So that's, been a fun challenge. And, but yeah, really with someone like Corey, who, as a coach, I've been fortunate to coach probably over 100 kids that have played college golf at this point. And I'm currently coaching 10 people playing golf for a living. So, I've been really blessed to have a bunch of good players, but, I would certainly put Corey's talent and work ethic and determination at the top.
Corey, you guys have been associates and friends for a long time. Describe Philip as a coach and then as a person.
Yeah, I mean, Phil's hands-on with me, and that's what I want. Phil's not, like I said earlier, he's not afraid to call me out, and we have that understanding that we're friends, but business is separate from our friendship. We can still go out and have a beer, talk sports, whatever, and have a great time. But the second we're on that course, we're trying to win championships, and if I'm doing something that he doesn't like, you know, he's going to call me out and he's going to instruct me the right way. And I think our business relationship and our friendship is separate. And I think that is why we're able to be so successful together.
All right. I'd turn the other cheek and Philip, ask you, describe Corey as a player and then as a person.
Yeah. I would say Corey's greatest asset, honestly, is his mind. He probably has the highest golf IQ, meaning an understanding of the sport that I've ever seen. I mean, it's really kind of just a brief story on that. I can't remember how old he was. I was caddying for him in a tournament and he was hitting a shot over water. And I said, I gave him the yardage and he goes, oh, hey, you know, it's going to play about 2 or 3 yards longer because we're going over the water. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, he's all, you know, the air density is cooler off the water and that makes the ball go a touch shorter. And, you know, so he's really got this extraordinary mind for the sport. I think we're going to probably shortly get into, you know, some of the adversities he's gone through. I think Corey was one of those people when he came out of college that, you know, a lot of people had pegged he would have been already have played in a few U.S. Opens. You know, I mean, he was he had such a good amateur career. And, but as a person and friend, I mean, like Corey said, we've just been good buddies for a long time. I think there's a mutual respect for what he's trying to accomplish because I tried to do it myself. And like I said, you know, he has higher talent and potential than I had. And so I just want to make sure that he's honoring that as he goes. But, you know, like Corey said, it's not unusual for us to talk sports and other things. And, we've just been good buddies for a long time. And he's always embraced when I'm hard on him, which I think makes him easy to coach.
Scott, it's remarkable that we had them both on the show today because I just figured out what's wrong with our golf games. We didn't take into account the air density over the water.
Well, the talent factor might be part of that too, Frank, but if you want to say the air density, I'll go with that.
Yep. Hey, Frank, he's the only person I played pro golf myself. I've been around a lot of great players. I mean, when it comes to understanding lies and weather conditions and wind, he's got a bit of a prodigal understanding of the sport. It's kind of hard to explain at some point.
I think I just get in the water.
Yeah, that's right.
We're talking with Corey Pereira, who just played in the U.S. Open at L.A. Country Club, and Philip Dawson, his coach from Performance Golf Academy. We have so much more to get into. You know, the for the casual observer that may have watched the tournament on television, it's just an easy process, right? You qualify for the U.S. Open and you play, and you either make the cut or you don't. And on Sunday we crown a winner. But Corey, obviously your story and how you got there is much more dramatic. Scott also happened to be at the U.S. Open. So what I want to do is take a little break here, and when we come back, talk about your journey to the U.S. Open and, have Scott kind of chime in on what he saw down there and see if we can all make sense of all of this. We will be back with more on the Golf to Go Radio Hour right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
We're talking with Philip Dawson, instructor of Performance Golf Institute, and Corey Pereira, who just played in the U.S. Open. Corey, your story about how you got there, you know, certainly was extraordinary. Most people are practicing all the time. Their games are sharp. You've had kind of a bumpy road getting to the U.S. Open. And I'm guessing that, being there was an incredible accomplishment for you and for everybody around you. But tell us a little bit about the issues. Some health issues with your girlfriend and your inability to practice for a while. Tell us what your story was and what it took to get to the U.S. Open.
Yeah, Frank. It's a long story. Back in October, my girlfriend was diagnosed with a rare and a very aggressive soft tissue cancer. And from there, you know, I sort of made the decision to shut down pro golf for the year, be with her and kind of see her through the rough next 8 months that she was going to have to go through. So from there, really, I shut it down for a good 3 to 4 months golf wise and was taking Leah chemo appointments, radiation, you know, really kind of putting in 110% for her, and, you know, nothing really left for golf. So, you know, kind of, I would say maybe March or so, I started to pick it back up, worked with Phil on some swing changes, some things I was kind of deficient at the last few years, and while taking care of Leah as well. And, you know, really didn't plan on playing any tournaments. And Phil kind of talked me into playing US Open local qualifying. And, you know, I was able to get away for a day or two from Leah and went down to Vegas just because all the California sites were full by the time I signed up, and went down to Vegas, shot 2 over on the front nine, shot 4 on the back, kind of figured something out, barely got in or barely got through local qualifying and was into sectional. Well, then I got to get away for 2-3 days for sectionals. So went out to Columbus, Ohio, and really midway through a swing change, I played one competitive round before that on the whole year, and went out to sectionals and checked 65 the first day and found myself right in the thick of things. So from there, I was able to play a really good solid second round of 70 and get through. And, you know, I would say just my expectations were low going into the week. You know, I hadn't played much golf. I'd practiced a little bit, worked on my swing with Phil, but, you know, really I was spending my time with Leah and her family trying to get her through this pretty awful diagnosis.
And then you tee it up at the US Open. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't Leah maybe cut into her chemo a little bit to come be there with you? That had to be really emotional and exciting for you at the same time.
Yeah, you know, she just went and begged her doctors, and they finally caved. They said, yeah, you know, we can push it out if need be. And so she was able to make it. And yeah, emotional is just an understatement. I mean, I found myself in tears out there on random holes where I just, you know, I'm trying to compete in a US Open. I'm up on tees, like, dreary-eyed, which it was just crazy. To have her there really meant the world to me after what we've been through. And our family's been really, really struggling, to be honest, for the last 8 months. And for her to see me living my dream out there, and for her to be there to support me through all this, through 10 rounds of chemo and 35 rounds of radiation, just a moment I'll never forget, to be honest.
Oh, I don't know how any of us could forget that. That's incredibly emotional and very touching. And we wish her and you continued success. Scott, you know, I don't know, how do you react to a story like that?
It's an amazing story. And I think that's what makes the US Open and just a game of golf so remarkable, is that it's really everybody's tournament. It's not just about who ended up winning, whether it was Wyndham Clark or McIlroy or Fowler, but it's all the stories for people getting in, like yourself, Corey. And I know Golf Channel, Todd Lewis, did a remarkable interview with you and your girlfriend that went nationwide and has become such the talk of golf as much as anything else going on. I just want to know what your reaction's been since playing in the tournament and the feedback and support you've received from that.
Yeah, it's been incredible, right? Just, you know, our local community has been one thing. They've come together, and we have a special group of people up here in Northern California at Camp Park Country Club. But really the national and international community really got behind us too this last week. So it was special to see people kind of accept and relate to our story a little bit, and just those words of support. And, it was just really cool to see everyone, out there for us.
Yeah. I had the chance. I walked part of the course with you. I'm sure you didn't notice, but I was out there for a few holes, and I had a chance on Friday to see you, birdie 6 for the second consecutive day, that par 4 where you could decide to go left or right or go straight for the green. Talk about just playing in that tournament, and particularly just some of the choices, like on 6, when you were able to have such success.
Yeah, 6 is a cool hole, man. It's just, there's so many different ways you can play that. And, you know, the pin was in an interesting spot where actually Phil talked me into laying it up left. I wanted to go for it, just, you know, I wasn't having a great round and I kind of needed some sort of fireworks to maybe make the cut, but Phil talked me into probably the proper strategy there. And I was able to use that backstop and funnel the ball in close. And, man, I wanted to make that birdie. I didn't want to get shut out the second round. So, yeah, that was a cool moment to get that ball in there close.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And you had a great round on Thursday, shot 71. You were hovering right around the cut line. Obviously, the conditions were a little bit more challenging on Friday than Thursday in terms of the length that they played it at and some of the pin positions. Can you talk about maybe the difference between Thursday and Friday? You got off to it such a great start.
Yeah, there was. You know, I thought Friday there were some opportunities for scoring. The course was a little softer than maybe we anticipated. It was still really, really hard. I would say if you drove the ball in the rough, you were going to have a lot of nightmares out there. And I can speak from experience on that one. But Thursday, I played really well. You know, I was able to hole a lot of 12 to 15 foot putts, a lot of par putts. And, I kept myself in it. And that's really all you can ask for that first day of a U.S. Open debut when there's nerves and, you know, lack of playing experience and, you know, all that stuff. So that was a great round to get started with. And yeah, Friday, I just thought the course did play harder. The pins were a little more tucked. Course played a little longer, and I was probably a little more off. And at a U.S. Open, that's going to result in, you know, a few over par. And I think I shot six over. But yeah, it wasn't easy out there.
I think, Frank, real quick, just before, you know, being out there with him and watching him play at sectionals, and he's being super humble, but you know, it's also the pressure and stress these players are dealing with, right? You know, I mean, you've got U.S. Open sectionals. I can only imagine how he felt. I was carrying the bag and I was really nervous. You know, I've been fortunate to play in that a few times myself, and I've never really had a great shot with six holes to go to qualify for the Open, unfortunately. And he did. And it was, you know, how he handled that moment, I think, was really impressive and, you know, a testament to his will. And then I just thought at the U.S. Open itself, you know, we got to play practice rounds with Max Homa and Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay, you know, and all three of those guys are top 10 in the world. And, you know, people don't really realize how close all these players are. You know, physically, you know, the day we played with Xander and Patrick, I mean, Corey's game looks, they're equal. And obviously, you know, if you go back and you look, you know, Corey and Xander were co-medalists at the California State Amateur one year together. So, I mean, Xander's caddy, Austin, made a really cool comment to me where, as a compliment to Corey, he goes, nobody in this field is surprised Corey's here. They're surprised it took him this long to get here. You know, and I think that, you know, I thought that was a cool comment. And, you know, for me watching him, it was also just, you know, what he's had to go through this year to get there. I mean, I told him he's played Korn Ferry Tour the last 2 years. I said, had you played Korn Ferry all year and made the U.S. Open, that I would have been, holy cow, what an amazing accomplishment. The fact he played zero competitive golf this year and was able to get through that thing and have a good chance to make the cut in the U.S. Open, I think speaks volumes to his talent.
You know, I was going to ask you that we've come full circle here. You know, the little kid that was watching you practice and you're on the bag there on the first tee at the U.S. Open. What was going through your mind, Phil?
Wow. Pride. Yeah. You know, obviously we're both so hyper competitive too. I was trying to get into play mode quickly, you know, because I mean, also, I know how good he is, and I wouldn't have been surprised at all if he had had a great tournament and you know, finished in the top 20 or even made a run at winning, you know. So I was trying to get my brain in the right place to get into, hey, it's time to play. But, you know, we did a good job too, especially towards the end of the second day when we knew, you know, without some kind of a crazy finish, we were probably going to miss the cut. You know, he kind of said something like, hey, let's really soak this in, you know, and, you know, obviously our hope is he's going to be in a bunch of these things and, you know, that he's going to get where I think he belongs, which is amongst the best players in the world. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, how do you dream that big, right? You know, I mean, it's like really hard when these guys are little kids. I coach a bunch of them, you know, to really dream that big is amazing. I had another longtime student, you know, was runner up in the U.S. Amateur a couple of years ago. I got to play in the U.S. Open in the Masters, Charlie Osborne. And, you know, to really see what those guys do is amazing. And I guess just to be standing there with him was, yeah, just a large sense of pride.
You know, Corey, we're running up against time, which is always an issue on the show. But just quickly, we always hear people refer to, this was always my dream. You know, as a little kid, this was my dream. on the first tee, you know, when you were standing there on Thursday, what was going through your mind?
Just honestly, exactly that. You know, I've been working for 20 years for this. And this is honestly, this was my life's work, you know, to go play in major championships. So, yeah, just how hard Phil and I have worked and just, you know, how lucky I am to be here, to be doing something that I put that much time into, and just how excited I was to go compete and live out my dream that week.
Corey, where do you go from here? What's next on your schedule?
Yeah, you know, I really haven't signed up for much. Leah's got two more chemo treatments and really want to get her through that. But maybe eyeing a couple Monday qualifiers, the Barracuda Monday qualifier pops out to me as an event I'd love to get into and compete kind of in my backyard. And also working with Phil and completing some of our swing changes that we've been that we started early in this year. And, you know, we still have some work to do. And I want to get to the point where I'm playing the U.S. Open once a year.
I think that's a great goal. I can't tell you how much fun it's been to have you both on the show. Corey, your story is inspiring. Phil, appreciate you standing by him all this time, and your relationship is admirable. Thank you so much, Phil Dawson and Corey Pereira and Scott Marsh. You know, we wrap up another show here.
Thanks, guys.
Always great. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for being on with us, guys.
Appreciate it.
Back with more right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
Welcome back in. You are listening to the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports 1140. I'm Frank LaRosa. He's Scott Marsh. And Scott, you know, we're going to our next guest. How about this? He's in the Florida State Hall of Fame for Florida State University. He's a Super Bowl winner. He's an Emmy Award winner as well. And it's hard to find that combination in anyone, but we found it here in Mr. Mike Schumann. Mike played for the 49ers and some other National Football League teams, was a Bay Area sports reporter on television and radio for so many years. And we've got him here today. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Doing great, guys. It's good to be back on air. I'll say that.
So. Appreciate you taking the time. You are going to be here in Sacramento. Well, actually you live up this way now as well, but next month you'll be appearing at the Gold Rush Classic at Rancho Murrieta, which is a charity celebrity AM tournament, and we have a lot of people that are very interested in that coming up, and we're going to talk about that certainly and how people can get involved in that tournament. But we'd be remiss without talking about, I don't know, let's start with the fact that you were on a Super Bowl winning team with, I don't know, some guy named Montana. A few years.
Yeah, that was, almost 40 years ago now. 1981 season, the 82 Super Bowl. And lucky for us, it was the first one ever played up in the North, and we got to go to Detroit. So snowed the whole time. I think they had a tour of Motown and a Cadillac plant for us. That was the entertainment. And so Joe was only in his third year and wasn't quite a household name. Dwight Clark, who inherited my job when I got injured. I always used to tease Dwight. And guys who really hadn't made their mark yet, but it was almost fate and destiny written all over it, as Bill beat the team, Cincinnati, Bill Walsh, that basically blackballed him from the league. He was an assistant there under Paul Brown for years, thought he was going to get the head coaching job when Paul sat down. He gave it to Tiger Johnson. Bill went away and became the head coach at Stanford and then, of course, with the 49ers.
What an incredible personality he was. And as I was looking through your teammates, a local guy that went to my alma mater high school, Easton Ramson, was on that team as well.
Easton and I, here's a great story. When Bill came in, we were 2-14 the year before, and probably the worst 2-14 team in the history of the NFL, 1978. I was a starter on that team, so that tells you right there. Then Bill came in 79, and we were also 2-14, but probably the best 2-14 team at the league's ever seen. So Easton and I were, in our second years together, and we were the only veterans that had to share a locker. You know, that up and downstairs lockers. So I called it the duplex. And I went on to become Bill's first starter at wide receiver, along with Freddie Solomon. Eason had come in from Denver, I think. And he was a backup to Charlie Young that year, I think it was. So great guy. And he's kind of the prototype of tight ends today. A big guy who could run. I called him Sweet Feet because he just had these unbelievable moves into his break. And so great guy. He's overcome a lot of demons in his life, and he's turned his life around. So working with young, troubled children now, and just a great guy.
You're, as I mentioned, in the Florida State Seminole Hall of Fame. That's, you know, how do you go from that, you know, sort of big man on campus to being on a 2-14 football NFL football team? What's that transition like?
Well, believe it or not, my era at Florida State probably had the worst records in the history of the program. We were 0-11 my freshman year, 1-10, 3-8, 5-6. So my class did not have one winning season. And Bowden came in my senior year, and I was out. And then I came back for a fifth year, and we went 10-2. First team in Florida ever to win 10 games. So had we – and we had, I think, 8 freshmen in my class played in the NFL. So we had talent, but we just didn't have the coaching back then. But it prepared me to play in the NFL. We threw the ball almost every down, and when most teams were running the wishbone. So then when I got to the NFL, you know, I was ready to play right away. And that worked out for me when Bill came. So my second year in the league, I became a starter. So whereas if you played in the wishbone, you learned how to block, but really not how to read defenses, run routes, and that kind of thing. So worked out for me despite the record. And tell you what, 2-14 was almost like a winning season.
You know, Bill Walsh certainly, as I mentioned, was an incredible personality. What was it about him that was so magnetic that made him such a great coach?
Bill knew exactly what he wanted to do. He was kind of the first that would schedule meetings every minute of your meetings in practice. You know, we ran from drill to drill. We had things we did that he wanted to do, and plus had the West Coast offense, which we were spreading the field kind of horizontally, running shallow crosses instead of down the field. So most teams hadn't seen it, and he knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he finally got his team, the 49ers, and he put it to work. And being an assistant all these years, he had a great personality, fun guy to be around. But he could also turn on a dime. I remember he cut a guy in practice one day and just got tired of him, fed up with him. He said, get him out of here. He said, get him on a plane. He says, no, put him on a Greyhound bus. Get him out of here. And all of us are kind of putting our heads down, like, I don't want to look him in the eye, because they'll say, get him out of here too. You know, so he could show, he could be kind of a player's coach. And then at the same time, when he had to lay down the law, he could do that too. So you really wanted to play for him. He was so innovative, smart as a whip. He didn't like to be called coach. He wanted you to call him by his first name. And I was a rookie with the Miami Dolphins and Don Shula. If you called Don Shula by his first name, he would have cut you just for that. Yeah, you know, Bill, it was hard to call Bill, you know, you call him coach and he'd look at you. I said, oh, Bill. So he was quirky. He was, everybody read the story. We went to Detroit. He was there early and he dressed up as a bellhop to receive us coming off the bus. So here's this guy. I was the second guy off the bus trying to grab my bag. And I kind of thought he's trying to make money off me. I just forearmed him away. Coming down to the meeting, John Ayers says to me, oh, did you see Bill in the bellhop? I said, what? He goes, that was Bill. I said, oh, my God, I just forearmed him. I'll never get in the game. So had a great sense of humor, an unbelievable football mind, and he knew how to deal with egos, which is pretty much the main job of a head coach at the pro level.
Scott, when you think about those times, and you know, everybody has memories of that. That you know, from looking in, it seems like it was a lot of fun, huh?
Oh, it had to be. And Mike, obviously, you've been in the Bay Area for so long before moving up to Sacramento. What you've been telling us, basically, if you hadn't gotten hurt, that would have been you in the catch with Montana, pretty much.
Oh boy, All right, here's a great story. Dwight, of course, passed away from ALS, and God, I think it's almost 3 to 5 years ago now. And my daughter went to UC Santa Cruz, so I would go down every Tuesday. We'd have these lunches with Dwight, and then before he moved out to Montana. And one of the lunches, he kind of had this forlorn look, you know, and I said, what's going on? He goes, I got to tell you something. In that last drive, we were running in and out of the game, and we had these little signals, a wide receiver. So the two plays before the catch, we ran the same play to the other side, and Joe overthrew Freddie Solomon by 10 feet. Freddie should have been the hero, to tell you the truth. And Joe, we had 6 turnovers in that game. People don't remember that. You know, who wins an NFC title game with 6 turnovers? Mm-hmm. 3 interceptions, 3 lost fumbles. So called a timeout, and then Dwight just ran in the game. There was no signal or anything. I said, what time? He said, I got it. I got it, Shuey. So, okay, so we're in over there. About it. He makes the most iconic catch in the history of the NFL. We go on, thanks to Eric Wright grabbing Drew Pearson by the collar at the last minute, to our first Super Bowl. There's nothing like the first time you do anything. So he tells me the story. He says, that could have been you. I said, you know what, Dwight? Fate has a way of, you know, working himself into sports. Had I missed that catch, I'd have never worked 40 years in the Bay Area as a sportscaster because they had ran me out of town. Whereas you make the most iconic catch. And I had Freddie Biletnikoff and Dwight to a golf tournament once. And I finished with Freddie. And Freddie goes, is he still milking that one catch? You know, and Dwight's caught over 500 balls, but he took a beating. And he was a young kid out of Clemson. You know, Bill was just looking at his quarterback. I think it was Fuller was his name. I can't remember his first name.
Yeah, Steve Fuller.
And they needed a receiver. So Dwight came out. And Dwight reminded Bill of Chip Myers, who he had in Cincinnati. Chip was 6'5", kind of too light to play tight end, but a big target at the split end position. And he had Isaac Curtis. So Chip and Isaac, and that's what he ended up with, Dwight and Jerry Rice. So, because Dwight also, he only caught like 10 passes in 4 years at Clemson. He was raw, but 6'4", 210, was kind of the new prototype of that bigger receiver. And so, yes, in the back of my mind, I always thought, you know, did Dwight just run in the game? And then he finally admitted it to him because it was just tearing him up inside.
Could have been you, Mike. Could have been you. You mentioned about Fred Biletnikoff, and of course, you know, he's a Florida State guy as well. The Collegiate Wide Receiver Award of the Year is named after him. Just can you talk about your relationship with him? He's from our area as well.
Right. He's up in Roseville, and he just was back. He's from Erie, Pennsylvania. They just dedicated a stadium to him, a high school stadium. He was down in Florida for a golf tournament in Tallahassee. So he's been on the road. And Bobby Bowden was his receiver coach in 64, I think, at Florida State. Then Bobby became so Bobby compared me to Biletnikoff. And actually everybody did when I got there. Same height, same build, same kind of game. And Freddie and I got to work together with the Oakland Invaders of the USFL.
Yeah.
Freddie was a receiver coach. I had just retired. He called me and asked me if he wanted to play one more year. We had Anthony Carter, Derek Holloway, Gordon Banks. All three went on to the NFL. And so finally got to work with him. It was great. We just had the best time. But I always said to him, you ruined my life. He goes, what are you talking about? I got compared to you my entire life. You're the Super Bowl MVP. You're the face of the Oakland Raiders. You know, how do I top that? You know, so, but we're dear friends. We used to play golf a lot more. I think Freddie just turned 80.
Yeah.
And so a great guy. There was nobody like him, you know, in his era. You know, a lot of, quote, white receivers. But he had a little Baryshnikov in him. He just, you know, in the course of the stick-em, I said, as good a hands as you had, you know, and then Lester Hayes, the cornerback, had it all over. And Lester would tackle you, and then you'd have the stuff all over you, you know, so you're sticking everywhere. It was just, it made the whole game nasty. So thank goodness they got rid of it. So, but one of the greatest players in the history of the game.
Yep.
Just a great guy, and it really relates to the common person who hasn't played the game, and just one of my favorite all-time people.
We're talking with Mike Schumann, who played wide receiver for the 49ers and certainly went on to be in the Bay Area with radio and television for so many years. Mike, you know, there's the best athlete, there's the best teammate and all of that. What in whether your experiences either playing or when you were on television, which athlete, and I don't know if you, this is a fair question, was there one athlete that kind of stood out among all the others that made an impression on you, not only for his ability, but also as a person?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, because in high school, if you played at the pro level, in high school, you were better than everybody. College, you were still probably better. Then once you get to the NFL, everybody up there is as good as or better than you. And that was kind of the first time for a lot of us. So, you know, like, wow. I can remember I was a rookie with the Dolphins. I came off the line of scrimmage in the first preseason game. Everybody was moving so fast. I literally stopped in my first step. I just went, oh, my God. And that's when I realized that, boy, everybody up here can play. But in terms of just great athletes, I tell you, Joe was a great athlete. He was a great basketball player in Montana. And decided to go football, even though he had some tough time at Notre Dame. A lot of the coaches wouldn't commit to him, and finally his senior year. And but almost every player, I would say the wide receivers are the best skilled position. You know, DBs are just wide receivers with no hands. quarterbacks, you know, yeah, they're usually the best players in high school and college, but in the pros, it's a whole different act. So, but Joe was a great, you know, Jerry Rice. It's funny, though. Jerry Rice, Roger Craig couldn't play a lick of basketball. We had, like, a celebrity team. We'd go around and play high schools, this, that, and the other. Neither one of them could play a lick of basketball. Roger was a great hurdler and track. Jerry ran track himself. But so it was just funny. I always thought I was – if we had a little, you know – what do you call it? Decathlon with 10 different events. I would win almost every guy I matched up against. Yeah, I could play football, but I could also play hoops, a good golfer. I could play tennis. So, but everybody up there, Roger Worley, a defensive back with the Cardinals, unbelievable athlete, could run backwards as fast as I could run forward. He and Mike Haynes, I think, both ran 4.6 40s backpedaling.
Wow.
Well, you mentioned Jerry Rice, and obviously he's a mainstay up at the celebrity tournament in Tahoe. What kind of stick are you in comparison to Mr. Rice?
Well, I'm going to say I'll beat Jerry every time. You know, so I played in that event the first maybe 3 or 4 years, and then I got a job and had to work, couldn't work, play on the weekends. So, no, I had Jerry up to my tournament, and I'm out on a hole the whole time at par three, and you try to beat me. And you bet whatever you want against me. If you beat me, you win twice the amount. So Jerry comes up to my hole, and I said, close to the pin, I said, no, let's do long drive because we were over a lake. So we did it at the same time. There's about 8 guys on the tee box so they could see where they splashed. So I outdrove him, and I'm probably 10 years older than Jerry. So we did it for $100 or whatever. And he's, okay, I'll get you when we get in. So we get in. I said, dude, where's my money? No, this is another typical thing with athletes.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll get you. So he never got me. All right. So he owes me $100. So I'm playing in an event in Palo Alto, which is his home club. And I needed a glove. And so I went downstairs to the pro shop and a female pro. And I said, oh, she says, well, it's member only. We don't take cash. I said, put it on Jerry Rice's tab. And she goes, I can't do that. So I told her the background of the story. I'm going to have some fun with him. So the next month I see him. I say, hey, man, did you have a charge on your account at the golf? He goes, was that you? I said, yeah. Now you only owe me $80. And he still hasn't paid me that.
Of course not.
Frank Gore and I, every year, he went to Miami, Florida State. We bet on the game. He still owes me money from the run that Florida State has. So. But Jerry's a great guy, and he got into golf like most of us when our career's over. You need something to compete with, and golf turns out to be it for a lot of celebrity athletes.
Yeah, great, great stories. Mike is going to be playing in the Gold Rush Classic Celebrity Tournament at Rancho Marietta July 13th and 14th, and quite frankly, listeners have an opportunity to play with him or with O.J. Anderson, Jim Brown, Rod Martin, Mike Merriweather, Greg Ostertag. How about Reggie Theus, Kenny Thomas, Greg Vaughn? All of these celebrities will be getting together at Rancho Marietta to raise some money for charity and provide a great opportunity for people to have some fun, listen to some stories, and get involved. And there are still playing spots available at goldrushclassic.com. Mike, I'm sure you play in a lot of these. What is it about the Gold Rush Classic that makes it so much fun and raises so much money for charity?
Well, you know, I had played in it years and years ago, and then came up here, and John Jacobs, the promoter, an old friend, kind of got in touch with him, looking to do some MC work, and brought me up to the tournament last year. I couldn't go the previous year. But I think what makes it unique is, of course, the course is a great course. That's where I play normally. And a lot of tournaments will just have NFL players, you know, or just NBA players. This tournament has Major League Baseball, NBA, and NFL players. So it's fun for we, quote, celebrities. I consider myself a D-list. Because we love to talk trash. And that's what you miss the most about playing at the pro level, is in the locker room, the camaraderie. So I had Pete Shaw come up to me, old safety with the Chargers. He goes, Mike Schumann. And I couldn't quite place him. He goes, you're the only, what was it? Some, the only brother to catch a touchdown on me, something. And then it hit me. I went, oh, Pete Shaw, San Diego Chargers. You know, so you just, it's a lot of fun to reminisce, number one, to give each other a lot of grief. Because, like, for instance, basketball players, with their height, they're a little, it's a little more difficult with them with golf. Hockey players are great in golf because that's their normal swing. Pitchers in baseball, because they only pitch every 4 days. And so it's just a great event. It's really well done. They have a draft for all the people playing in it that you can draft whoever you want to play with. So last year, you know, a couple of us have been out of the league for 40, 50 years. Nobody's going to remember us. So it was funny to see, you know, professional athletes concerned that they might not get drafted. You know, I can't remember the kid from the A's. He goes, shoot, nobody's in. I said, don't worry, man, you'll get drafted. So, and John sets it up that if not, you know, the big sponsor pays for it, and this, that, and the other. So, but it's just funny to see the most confident guys, athletes, showing insecurity. It's almost like draft day again, you know. Yeah. Not getting drafted. So just a lot of fun, a lot of camaraderie, hole-in-one contest. And even if you don't play, you can come out and watch and get rub shoulders with some of these players. So it's there's a vibe about it that matches no other one that I've played it. So I'll just say that about it.
July 13th and 14th at Rancho Marietta, the Gold Rush Classic. And as I said, if you want to play, go to goldrushclassic.com. Mike, I can't thank you enough. I wish we had more time for some of these stories. We just have to have you back on the show or go play some golf with you, one or the other.
I'd love to come back. You know, I tell people I'm a great fourth in golf because not only do I play in the top level, I won a Super Bowl, and then I covered 3 Giants World Series, 4 Warriors Championships, Sharks in the Stanley Cup, you know, so I've just got a lot of stories as a result. So I'd love to come back and join you guys.
Look forward to meeting you in person at Rancho Marietta, and thanks much for your time today. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sactown Sports, 1140. This wraps up another week. Appreciate you being with us, Scott Marsh and Frank LaRosa. We'll see you next time.